the first page of the notes, there are some outlines which come straight from Lama Tsongkhapa's graduated path, the Lamrim. In the middle, there are the six disadvantages of not remembering impermanence and death during our life. The first is listed here. We will forget to practice Dharma, thinking that our life will go on forever, so we'll always have time to practice. Second disadvantage is even if we remember the importance of practicing Dharma, we procrastinate. And so, you know, we just don't get around to actually doing it. And I, as you know, the meaning of practicing Dharma is to consciously train our mind to be in a virtuous attitude, a non-harmful, benevolent attitude towards others, and to constantly be on guard and watchful for our mind slipping into selfishness, self-centeredness, and non-virtue, and to prevent those thoughts from taking over, and also to purify past negative actions that we may have done. So this is the essence of the spiritual path and the meaning of practicing Dharma. So the third disadvantage of not remembering that, you know, life is so short, I don't have much long, is that our, we do practice, but our practice is contaminated by the eight worldly thoughts or the eight worldly concerns. We'll come to them next. The fourth problem is that even we do practice and our practice is pure, we don't persevere. We have to keep going. We should never think, I've done well, I can now take a rest. We need to constantly train our mind. I mean, this goes for practicing Dharma. It goes for anything in life. You know, if you want to study a subject, become a professional in any particular activity, you need to do these things. You need to overcome the phone calls from your friends. Oh, they're having a great party. Come, don't study tonight. And our motivation is pure to practice, but we don't persevere. We easily take a break. We need to take breaks. Taking a break is one of the bodhisattva's practices, to know that when our mind has reached its tipping point, if I push too hard, I'm going to totally lose it. Maybe go crazy or whatever. So bodhisattva skillful practice is to take a break when our wisdom tells us it's time to have a break. So normally it's not wisdom telling us, it's self-centeredness, attachment telling us you need a break. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to really know what to do at times. My teacher, Geshe Dhamma Techo, he I remember once he said to us that when you're practicing Dharma, it can be very confusing. Do I do this? Or do I don't do that? Or, you know, just how far should I go? And we end up sort of being a bit paralyzed and not being able to do much at all. But he said, he gave them his practical advice. He said, if you have a thought to do something and there's a certain amount of, you know, pleasure, self-benefit in that action, but it's also a benefit for others. So he said, weigh up the effects of the action you're thinking to do. And if the benefit for others is greater than the self-benefit, you know, for me, then do it. But if the benefit really, I'm doing it more for me than for others, then don't do it. So we have to be practical and relaxed in Dhamma practice. I know of so many examples of people who are much too tight, very strict. Lay people, ordained people, really, really strict. And apparently, wow, so pure, taking precepts every day, doing all this. But these are very, not always, but often they're the ones who just throw in the towel. You know, monks, nuns, disrobe. Because they've been too tight. Then there are others who are too loose. They're just not tight enough. So I think in the Love Room it says practicing Dharma should be like playing a stringed instrument where the strings to get that beautiful sound is not too tight, not too loose. That's how we should be with our mind. It's really good advice. Okay. The fourth disadvantage of not remembering death is that we do vulgar or negative actions. We accumulate strong negative karma, which makes us unsuitable to achieve liberation or even a happy rebirth. And finally, when we do approach death, then we have so many regrets in having wasted our life. So the six advantages on the other side of that table. The first is that our actions, our remembering impermanence and death, our actions become purposeful, we don't waste time. Next, our Dharma practice is very powerful and very effective. Next three, remembering impermanence supports our practice in the beginning, in the middle, and at the end. And finally, when we do die, we die pleasantly and happily. We're prepared for death. The eight worldly concerns, I'm sure you've heard, these are the attractions and aversions for happiness and unhappiness in this life, worldly. So we need to be familiar with these because so often these contaminate our apparent Dharma actions. You know, like we're going to be meditating and really sitting beautifully back straight and all that. But what we're thinking is, the other people must think I'm such a good meditator. You know, there's this pride. And even there is some inner experience of peace, of bliss, or whatever. We feel special. And we sort of go to the teacher, I'm special. You know, recognize, praise me. Say nice things. I'm getting somewhere. We were meditating. We were achieving something. We're doing some activity. But when that attitude is there, that is the contamination of worldly Dharma. One time, I'd stayed at Kopan, it was when I was, after being ordained, I was living at Kopan Monastery in the 70s. And I'd stayed there for the whole monsoon. I'd done retreats, you know, a 6-week Manjushri retreat, and some other retreats. And I'd worked really hard. The monks and nuns were living in their region at Kopan, and I'd worked really hard. Looking after the buildings and the kitchen and the shopping. And I'd run a clinic. I had a free medical clinic for the local villages, which kept me really busy, like 8 o'clock in the morning to midday. In fact, I even had a mantra. Because all the little monks, too, they'd all come up. And they'd come up to me at any time of the day. So I learnt a phrase in Nepali language, Boli Biena Atbaji, and that means tomorrow morning 8 o'clock. That's when the clinic opens, not now at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's really funny because some of the Kofan monks were little monks then, they're adults now. I was in Bendigo in Australia at the monastery, and I walked past a room and there was a visiting monk, Geshe Sherab. He's probably been here. I didn't know he was there, and the doors opened. I heard from inside the room, Boli Biena Atpaji. It was Geshe Sherab. So he remembered. Anyway, I thought I'd been a good monk during those monsoon. And Lama Yeshe returned to Copan after travelling overseas. And so all the monks, all the Westerners who were there, all in a big long line with scarves, you know, cutters to hand to Lama Yeshe, and he began at the bottom, coming up, greeting each one in turn. And then sort of went one after the other. And then he came to the one next to me, and I was sort of thinking, Lama must be really pleased with what I did over the monsoon. So Lama met this person, and then he totally walked past me. I went to the next one. Didn't look at me, he ignored me. And I checked up, yep. I wanted praise, you know. Nice words. So again, the gurus teach in very nice ways. So the 8 worldly concerns contaminate a dhamma. And I just list them. I know you've been through them before. But my very first course, the 1 month course at Copan, was the 6th course where I attended. It was my total introduction to Buddhism. I knew nothing about Buddhism. And Lama Zofa Rinpoche taught the course, and he spent 10 days, and he gave all the lectures, like a few hours in the morning, a few hours in the afternoon, 10 days on the 8 worldly concerns. I was nearly going crazy. Anyway, these are 4 sets of attachment and aversion. Attachment to material gain. You know, receiving gifts, money, and so on. Just attachment to material things and craving material things. And aversion to not having or losing material possessions. So that pair. This occupies our mind a lot. Then there's the attachment to the pleasure of sensory pleasures, good health, you know, attractive body, and so on. Doing so much to make a body look more attractive, and so on, and aversion to not having sensory pleasure, to missing out on what other people are enjoying, or losing what we've got. So a lot of our time is spent in indulgence, in the pursuit of sensory pleasure, and avoiding pain. Then there's the attachment. This to sweet, literally sweet, ego-pleasing words. That we really crave affection. We crave love. And for somebody to say, I love you. And we have straight aversion to not being, you know, to being criticized and not being loved, to being rejected or losing out on the affection of others. I often, you know, I say that when we're little babies, we're so helpless, and we rely so much upon our mother. Our mother, who I often say she nourishes our body with the milk from her breast, and she nourishes our mind with the love from her heart. And that's really true. Little babies, little children need affection. Even scientifically, we've shown that young children deprived of affection and love, even their physical growth is retarded, and the psychological development is impaired through the mere lack of love and affection. So, receiving love is a type of nourishment, as is the milk from our mother. But we're all weaned from our mother's breast, but actually, we're not, many of us, most of us, are not weaned from our mother's heart. And as we grow up more and more, we're still craving the affection and love of others, recognition. And as, of course, we modify our behavior as teenagers and as adults according to social norms, but there's still, we haven't been weaned. And even as adults, our happiness is very much dependent upon affection. It becomes harder and harder. And we even our partners, we start seeing partners as mother substitute or father substitute. Not as another independent person like myself, you know, an adult, but a substitute from whom we demand affection and attention. It's so complicated here, we know the relationships and so on. But there is this fundamental craving. And very often we live our whole life still in need of recognition. We want our lama to pat us on the head and say, good boy, good girl, done a good job. And so, I think really maturing as an adult is to wean ourselves from the craving for love and affection. And how do we do that? How do we maintain our self-esteem, our self-confidence, and so on? By giving love to others. By being genuinely affectionate and kind to others, there is no greater boost to self-esteem than doing that without demanding anything in return, genuine, outgoing love and compassion. We all need self-confidence, self-esteem. But until we mature, until we grow up, and remaining always reliant upon others, we will always be doubtful about our inner quality, whether we're a good person or a bad person. We want others to tell us that. Or we want our bank account, or our beautiful big car. I was reading about the latest Lexus car. Built very much just for personal comfort, but as illustration, here am I, my lovely car. But that's not enough. But just giving food to a hungry animal and rejoicing in a bird or something is a pure, genuine cause for inner joy. And there are so many opportunities, not just animals, but there are so many people to whom we give happiness. Of course, most animals respond very happily. Humans are more difficult. You know, we can try and help people and we can be rejected, be insulted, criticized. But that's okay. That's the other half of this worldly thought. Fear of being rejected, fear of being ignored or bad things being said to us. That should have no effect whatsoever. The genuine attitude of affection and giving love to others, this is the most precious thing in the world. If we regard things as precious if they make us happy, and not precious if they don't make us happy, then most things in ordinary life are very expensive. You know, precious is a synonym of expensive. But in terms of giving inner peace and happiness, nothing is better than genuine kindness, affection, love for others. Now, of course, they're attached to love. They're attached to affection. Yeah. But that's okay. So are children. But children need it. Children need love. They need kind words. Eventually, we have to teach the children to be self-sufficient. How do we do that? We teach them to love others. Anyway, that's just a side point. And I think it's an important point. The final two pairs of these eight worldly concerns, you know, craving for, you know, being loved, that's more personal. But in general, craving for social recognition, for reputation, for fame, and aversion for notoriety, for being socially disgraced, loss of reputation, and power. So even I usually include in the section craving for power and influence, and aversion to not having power and influence. I think those things are quite evident in our society. Okay. So those thoughts, those worldly thoughts are actually encouraged in society. But if we really check up, they weaken our Dharma practice, they contaminate our Dharma practice. It's Dharma practice is pure without any self-centeredness. So we can always check up. Mindful, what am I thinking? Why am I thinking this? Is this action of greater benefit for others or myself? And gradually we can train our mind to go from happiness to happiness. Okay. Now, next subheading, it's the causes of death. Now we're getting down to it. So, when we died, there was a collection of karmas which ripened when we died in our last life. So this collection of karmic potencies ripened to be born as a human being in the human realm. It wasn't just the human body that was determined by the various karmas that ripened as we were dying. Also, the duration of life of that human body is a karmic ripening that occurred when we died in our past life. In other words, we were all born with a karmically determined lifespan. And that lifespan cannot be changed. It could be, we could even die in the womb, so it was very short, or soon after birth, or as a toddler, or as a teenager, middle age, old age. But we do have a karmically determined lifespan. And when that karmically determined lifespan is finished, that's the end of the line. It can't be increased. And we do have long life practices, long life mantras, long life practices, initiations. And these are important because we can die before our karmic lifespan is up. Through different situations, it's possible to die earlier. So the benefit of the long life initiations and long life practices is to reduce the power of those other circumstances which can cause us to die before our lifespan is up. Right? Now, this is according to the sutra teachings of Buddha. There are tantric teachings, tantric practices, whereby we can extend our life. We can always, doing it properly, we can overcome death altogether. But not talking about those profound tantric practices, in general, we can't extend it. Okay, so the first cause of death is exhaustion of karmic lifespan. Another point here is that when the karmas ripen in our last life, as we were dying, for this human life, not only was our lifespan determined, but our gender. We have a karmically determined gender, to be male or female, also ripen at the time of death. And I mean, this is evident, but we'll talk about the bardo, or the intermediate state, in more detail later on. But as soon as we die in this life, we experience this dreamlike bardo, or intermediate existence between one life and another. And already, in the bardo, our future gender is determined. So we'll have a male aspect or a female aspect of the future life. We'll come back to this point when we talk about the bardo. The second cause of death is the exhaustion of merit. So in particular, the karmic merit to obtain the necessities for survival, such as food, clothing, or shelter. So through negative karma, although we still have the potential to live longer, but we don't have the potential to get what we need right now, the right food, the right medicine, whatever we need to stay alive. And so we die. The unused lifespan is not lost. That is a virtuous karmic ripening, and that will be experienced sometime in a future life. The third condition that is associated with an untimely death, that is associated with death, is weakening of the life-supporting wind. I'll talk about the winds in a minute, but this is, humans can have an untimely death due to carelessness, putting oneself in danger, or doing things such as that could have been avoided. These are the examples given in the text: overeating, eating unhealthy or poisonous things, using medicines or drugs inappropriately, and risky behavior, thinking, I can do that, but we're really not as clever as we think we are, and we put ourselves in a life-threatening situation which we can't handle. So these are more psychological attitudes that attract us to dangerous situations where we can die. Okay. Now, at the top of the second page, there are stages or steps in the process of dying. So often we hear it in Buddhist teachings. If we ask, what is a human being? Then it's an interesting question. What is a human being? I heard one Lama say, well, a human being is simply a person who looks and thinks like we do, like us. Conventionally, we're human beings. And our type of human, there can be humans of different aspects. We talked about them last weekend. The first humans in this world had bodies of light. They didn't eat, they didn't need to eat, and they were born spontaneously and so on. But our type of human is somebody who looks at and thinks like us. So a human being has a body like ours and a mind like ours. So the body and mind, looking like that, that's what we distinguish as a human being. So if we look in more detail, Buddha said, well, a human being has these five collections or aggregates. One is a collection of physical qualities, our limbs, our trunk, our organs, and you know, all the components of the body. These all collectively is the form aggregate or the body aggregate of a human being. Then there's the mind. And so Buddha distinguished particular aspects of mind. He said there's all the feelings. The feelings refer to the mental experiences of happiness, unhappiness, a neutral feeling, sensory and mental consciousness. And then there's the collection of discriminations or recognitions. And this is the mental activity which is able to discriminate or distinguish between different things. And then thirdly, the remaining part of the mental activity is called the aggregate of volitions, which is all the other emotions, constructive emotions, destructive emotions, and any other changing quality associated with the human are all lumped together in this fourth aggregate of volitions. And finally, there's the fifth aggregate of consciousness, which refers to the connection of the five sense consciousnesses and mental consciousness, our sixth consciousness. So the five aggregates. And as I mentioned last weekend, why did Buddha distinguish? Like there are 51 mental factors and feeling and discrimination, those are two of them. Why did Buddha separate those out from the other 49? Why aren't there 52 aggregates? And Buddha, in the Abhidhamma, explained that Buddha talked about feelings in terms of your happiness, unhappiness, and neutral feeling, because those, the pursuit of pleasure and avoidance of pain, are the basis of dispute amongst ordinary beings. They're the main basis of fighting dispute. And discriminations, this is this, that is that, are the basis of dispute amongst scholars and monks and nuns. You know, those more intellectually inclined, that they dispute over their understanding of reality. This is emptiness, not that. I know emptiness. That sort of thing. Okay, so I mentioned the five aggregates because these come up in the death process. Now secondly, we can also look at the body and mind from the point of view of gross, subtle, and very subtle aspects of body and mind. In terms of the body, the gross body is this karmically acquired form aggregate, you know, the body aggregate. All the physical things that we recognize about the body. The subtle body is a description of the more subtle relationship between the body and the mind. And in the tantric texts, there is a description of channels within the body through which subtle physical energy called wind flows, and this flowing wind is always associated with consciousness. So there are three entities in the subtle body. Channels, drops, and winds. These are physical entities. They are not composed of atoms or molecules. If you dissect the human body, you'll see, you know, with a scalpel, then you'll find arteries and veins and nerves and so on visible to the eye. But those aren't the channels described in the tantric texts, which give a map or a plan for meditation. So no need to go into the great detail of these descriptions, but in general they're said to be a central channel which can be, according to the particular meditation, can begin at top of the head or here between the eyebrows, and it's said to be the diameter of your little finger, and it curves back and it flows down to the pelvic region, and there are two side channels beside it, and at different points along that central channel there are radiating channels which branch and rebranch and so pervade the whole body. This is the general picture. So this is what we call the channels. Those branching points with the radiating branches look like a wheel, the spokes of a wheel. So the Sanskrit word is chakra, chakra meaning wheel. There are many different types of chakra. The five main ones: the crown chakra, the throat chakra, heart chakra, navel chakra, and the lower chakra. So these are the major points. Within those, so the central channel, I said, is the diameter of your little finger. The others are smaller diameter. At the chakras and on the inner lining of the channels, imagine if I had a glass of like really cold water, then on the outside of the glass you get condensation of moisture, little droplets of moisture will occur. So mostly the chakras, but also on the inner lining of these channels, there's bindu. Sanskrit is bindu, which in English we translate into drop or droplet. And those, so they're red derived from the mother and white derived from the father. So these are scattered on the inside of the central channel. So that's what the drops refers to. And in the hollow part of the channel are the winds. These winds are the most subtle aspect of form, of matter, and they're material, but again, it's more subtle than atoms and molecules. But this wind energy is associated with consciousness, whether it's a sensory consciousness or mental consciousness. Whenever the mind is active, there is the movement of wind energy. Also the drops. Whenever the drops are moved, if they're moved by the wind energy itself, then that is also associated with mental experience of bliss. Okay. Now, the mind... Sorry, we're still... The very subtle wind is called the most subtle wind of clear light. And that is the wind energy that always abides in the center of the heart chakra. Now, the mind has gross, subtle, and very subtle as well. Gross mind refers to the six main or primary consciousnesses and the 51 mental factors that I mentioned. The mental factors include, you know, ever-present ones, we've already mentioned two of them, feelings, discriminations, intention, mental engagement, and contact of the mind with its object. And then there are virtuous mental factors. There are afflictive mental factors, primary and secondary, and so on. So that's all gross mind. By the way, if you have a question at any time, you're welcome to ask. Subtle mind refers to the subtle visions which occur during death. When we are awake and alert, the wind energies are flowing in the periphery of this branching channel system that pervades our body. And they're associated with physiological functions, which we'll talk about. Even when we're awake, there are times when we're very alert and active, and times when we're becoming drowsy. So what's happening is that there's like this coming, there's this more, we're more alert, more awake, the winds are flowing in the periphery. As we become drowsy, they tend to be contracting inwards. And then that process of alertness and drowsiness, that goes in cycles. And there are times when our drowsiness becomes stronger and stronger, and then so the winds are coming closer and closer, and we fall asleep. So falling asleep is associated with the winds leaving the periphery. The winds no longer flow through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and touch. So as we go to sleep, we progressively lose our sensory awareness. The sense organs are not functioning. Not completely. So during sleep, there's also the expansion and contraction in a more subtle way. Very, very, very deep sleep, the winds are very, very gathered in towards the central channel. Not in the central channel, but towards. When we start dreaming, the winds start to become more active. And then maybe go back to deep sleep, then dreaming. So there's similar fluctuation of alertness and dullness even in sleep. Dying is just the same process. When we die, just like going to sleep, the winds come in and in, but they keep going. They enter the central channel. So, just briefly, subtle mind refers to where the winds are flowing down. There's a white, red, and black visions. So these occur during death, when the winds start flowing down from the top of the body into the crown chakra, go down towards the heart chakra, and there's a white vision. And that's then the winds from the lower part of the body coming up, and they're flowing up towards the heart chakra. And you get the red vision. This inner vision occurs in the mind. It's not eye consciousness, it's mental consciousness. And then all the winds come together at your heart chakra, and you get the black vision. And after the black vision, all the winds have absorbed into the heart chakra, and the most subtle mind is called the mind of clear light. So remember, the most subtle body is the wind of clear light. Clear light refers to the mental experience at that time. Clear light, said to be like at night before dawn, when the sun is below the eastern horizon and there's just a hint of light in the black night sky, indicating that the sun is going to rise, but very faint. So that's a clear light. So at that point, that's the final moment of death, there is the most subtle wind and the most subtle mind. Now remember, I said that the wind is the supports the mind. So what you have at that point, at that final moment of death, is the clear light experience, the mind of clear light, and the wind, the clear light wind, which supports that mind. What we have in our heart chakra at that time is manifesting, in technical terms, it is called the eternal drop. Now, it's called eternal because this has existed since beginningless time and will continue to exist endlessly into the future. So it's eternal, truly, for it was never created, it will never be destroyed. It is present now in the middle of our heart chakra, but we're not aware completely. No, it is far, far, far too subtle. Unless we're a meditator, we can't recognize it. So even though it's eternal, no beginning, no, it changes moment by moment. So that means impermanent. You know, the meaning of permanence is not changing moment by moment. So this does change moment by moment. The previous moment of the eternal drop is the ceases and gives rise to the present moment. The present moment ceases and gives rise to the future moment, and so on. Is that clear? Yeah. No. Well, look, it depends. The alaya, or the ground consciousness, is in the Chittamatran presentation of tenets, refers to a more coarse type of consciousness. But I know that our friend Alan Wallace, who you probably met, Alan Moss, who does talk about the ground consciousness, I think in his terminology he could be referring to this. Yep, just terminology. Okay, so that's just a preview, right? So we can understand this process. It's so important. Not, of course, the lung room, the graduated path, is actually a preliminary practice for Tantra, for the Vajrayana. The final outline of the graduated path is Vajrayana, which means that all of the so many outlines prior to that have led up to the final outline. So actually, the lum rim, which people say, oh, I've heard lum rim, why don't you teach me Tantra? It is Tantra. It is a preparation of the mind for Tantra. You cannot enter the Vajrayana without renunciation, without bodhicitta, without understanding emptiness. And of course, this particular description is not overtly, what's the word, expressly given in the texts, but in the commentaries, it is there. So the five root winds that support mind and bodily functions. So I've mentioned the channels with the winds flowing inside them, we can look, there are five main types of wind activity that support the mind and bodily functions. So the first is called the life-supporting wind. So this wind maintains, it's associated with staying alive, with breathing. And it supports the five senses and is based at the heart. So this life-supporting wind, in supporting the five senses, it gives rise to the wind energy which flows through the eye organ when we have eye consciousness, through the ear organ, we ear consciousness, smell, taste and touch. They're often called the five secondary winds, the winds associated with the five sense consciousnesses. So they are all derivatives of the life-supporting wind. So at a gross level, the life-supporting wind is associated with the six main types of consciousness and the 51 mental factors. At a subtle level, it is the life-supporting wind which is associated with that white vision, the red vision, and the black vision, and finally, the clear light. It is that clear light wind, that most subtle wind, is the life-supporting wind at the heart chakra. Then, there are other more coarse winds can be described. These are all associated with mind and with bodily or physiological functioning. The downward voiding wind abides in channels in the pelvis, and it is associated with the functioning of excretion, of urine and feces, the activities of the pelvic organs, giving birth. So as wind is inseparable from mind, then we know that there are certain medical or psychological conditions where it's maybe difficult to pass urine or so on, where there is dysfunction of the organs of the pelvis associated with mental anxiety or mental activities. So the movement of wind is associated with mind. If there's anxiety, the wind can't function properly. So here in, actually, is an important, medical point. I think from Eastern medicine, from the Ayurveda, Tibetan medicine, Chinese medicine, there's recognition of acupuncture points, of pressure points, and certain activities which Western medicine rejects. But there is a valid basis for these various therapeutic methods associated with stimulating or blocking or manipulating the flow of wind energy in the channels which is associated with mind. Okay. Third is the upward moving wind based on the throat chakra. And associated with the activity of the upper part, the swallowing, speaking, the mouth and the tongue. And also we know that if there's, say, giving a talk, and somebody's anxious, well, their voice gets high-pitched. Well, they can't talk. They have difficulty in formulating words. So, again, this is a psychological disharmony, anxiety, is inevitably associated with disruption of the smooth flowing of the wind. And so there's impairment even of speaking properly. Then there's the equally abiding wind associated with bodily heat and digestion and based at the navel chakra, associated with the function of the digestive organs. And in Western medicine, we call certain disorders psychosomatic, a psycho mind, soma body. So even in our Western terminology, we talk about body mind dysfunction, psychosomatic disorder. So there is recognition as reality, but there's no understanding of the means of how a disturbed mind causes disturbance in the physiological functioning of the body. Finally, the pervading wind associated with bodily movement located peripherally in the joints and the limbs. So that's just a very brief presentation of the winds and the function of the body. Now, the death process itself. The description, and this does come in the Lum Rim, is that there is weakening, or sometimes the term absorption is used, of the five aggregates. So in terms of those five aggregates, body, feelings, discriminations, volitions, and consciousness, the most coarse or the gross is the body aggregate, the form aggregate. Weakening means that the power of that particular aggregate weakens, becomes less, and it seems that the next becomes more dominant. But it's not that the feelings will become dominant, it's just that the body aggregate weakens, the feeling aggregate becomes, there's the next one. So we say absorbs, the term absorbing into. So death can, as I've already mentioned, during normal life, the winds are peripherally active and then contracting with alertness, drowsiness, and then more gross, awake, asleep, and even during sleep, dreaming, not dreaming. So yogis, meditators who are aware of their mental experiences, they can be aware that death is approaching 6 months before there are certain mental signs of this expansion, contraction. And this becomes more pronounced as we approach death. We're talking about somebody who's reaching the end of their karmic lifespan, so they're probably becoming progressively weaker, and ending up more time in bed, and they're just dying a so-called natural death, as opposed to, you know, a sudden death in a car crash or something. So a meditator can be aware that something's going on, death is coming. And so they clean up their affairs, they pay their debts, they purify the negative karma, and they get ready. They're quite okay about it. So, for somebody like ourselves, we're not meditators, but we are dying. So we're probably in a bed at home or in the hospital. And the first thing that weakens is the body aggregate, and the indications that this is happening is that the dying person, their limbs become thin and weak, difficult to move, difficult, you know, to hold a cup or anything. We've all seen this. The next indication is that the mirror-like wisdom. Now, we all, in our mind has a mental factor of knowledge. And knowledge has five basic qualities. We call the mirror-like, the wisdom of equality, the wisdom of individual discrimination, and so on. So these basic qualities of knowledge we all possess. And in fact, in following the path, accumulating wisdom on the path to Buddhahood, involves the progressive perfection of these fundamental qualities of wisdom which we already possess. They become greatly enhanced and perfected, and the perfection of each of the types of wisdom is represented by the five wisdom Buddhas. A lot of texts use the term Dhyani Buddha, but that is wrong. The term Dhyani Buddha was coined, I think, by Evans Wentz, who was one of the first Europeans to translate Buddhist texts into English and European languages, German, French, and so on. Actually, there is no equivalent. If you look at the text, Dhyani Buddha isn't there. Wisdom Buddhas is the correct term. And they, because they represent the perfections of our five types of wisdom or knowledge that we already have. Varachana, Akshobhya, Amitabha, Ratnasambhava, Amoghasiddhi. Right? So, the first of these ordinary knowledges, we call the mirror-like wisdom, for us, that is the capacity of our knowledge to realize many objects, such as pleasant, unpleasant, different things, all at the same time. It's called mirror-like because a mirror can reflect many different types of objects simultaneously. So that's the mirror-like wisdom that we possess. So this is represented by Buddha Varachana. Buddha Varachana, white, usually white in colour. And so the perfected mirror-like wisdom is the Dhammakaya wisdom that knows the extent of everyone and everything that exists throughout the universe. That's quite a big mirror. It knows all that's happening. Amazing. The sign that this is happening is that for the dying person, their vision becomes blurred and dark. They can't see clearly. Dying people say, "Oh, open the curtains, let the light in. I can't see you." Even relatives come, and their vision is becoming blurred, and they say it's getting dark in here, but it's not. It's just their experience. The third thing that happens during this absorption of the body aggregate. I'm suppressing a cough. Might take one of these. Excuse me. Okay, the earth element. In Buddhism and in many Eastern traditions, the elements, earth, fire, water, and wind, are not elements as we know them from physics and chemistry. They are qualities of matter. So, earth element refers to the property or the nature of solidity. Right? A lot of earth element in the table. It can support things. So the sign that the earth element of the whole body is weakening is that the dying person experiencing a sinking sensation, like falling, or a feeling of pressure on the chest. The same thing happens when we go to sleep. And I've noticed, occasionally, usually when I was younger, in a period of just going to sleep, you're not really asleep, you're not really awake. I remember suddenly feeling a sense of falling. And I put out my hands, you know, to support myself, but I'm lying flat on the bed. Not falling, but there's that sensation. Has anybody had that? I have. So that's the earth element. So actually, we experience death every time we go to sleep. It's just the same. The eye sense, the most dominant sense, begins to weaken at this stage. And the sign is that the dying person has difficulty in keeping their eyes open or closed, you know, their heart, even to open the eyelids or close the eyelids. And what's called the inner form weakening is that the colour of the body fades, become very pale, and the dying person has an inner vision like a shimmering silvery blue mirage of water on the hot desert sand. You know, the sun is actually refracting off the layer of hot air over the sand, and you get this silvery blue mirage. So that's the first of the five stages of death. This can happen quickly. It can happen over hours or even days. And we can go in and we can come out of death. It's not always a one-way process. So the next stage is the weakening of the feeling aggregate. The feelings of pleasure, displeasure, are neutral. In particular, of touch, they diminish. But subtle feelings still remain. The next wisdom is the wisdom of equality. For us, equality means seeing feelings as feelings, you know, simply, yeah, that's pleasure, that's pain. It's a feeling of seeing similarity in things. Patterns. Our knowledge of being able to distinguish patterns. This is represented, the perfection of this mundane knowledge which we possess is represented by Buddha Ratnasambhava, you know, yellow in colour. And so the perfection of this knowledge is the awareness of the equality of everyone as being all sentient beings, as being equal objects of compassion, and all, not only all beings, but everything is empty of inherent existence. So that's the vast wisdom, perfected wisdom, symbolized by Buddha Ratnasambhava. The water element, the next coarsest element, begins to weaken. Water element refers to the function of cohesion, holding together, and fluidity. The sign of this happening is the dying person, they stop sweating, they stop producing saliva, stop producing tears. These begin to dry up. And the dying person can complain of a very dry mouth. And nurses, you know, working in hospitals, nurses have told me that they recognize these signs in dying people. And it's a custom to, when a dying person complains of dry mouth, they give them a little piece of ice to suck on, and that helps, it alleviates temporarily what they're experiencing. The ear sense begins to weaken. Very difficult for the dying person to hear. You have to shout into the ears so that they can understand what you're saying. The inner sound stops. So that, you know, many people have the tinnitus, that ringing in the ears. Finally, the doctors couldn't stop it, but this time it stops. Relief. But you're dying. And the inner vision, instead of being like a mirage, is like a room full of smoke. I've experienced that one too. When I was very young, I know 6 or 7 years old, I had a dental procedure, not on my teeth, but on my gums. And I remember so clearly that when that was over, the dentist had stitched it up. I stood up from the dentist's chair, and I wondered why the surgery was full of smoke. And then I fainted. So when you faint, it's the same process as dying, same process as going to sleep. I could, even now, like so many years later, I can still see that surgery full of smoke and wondering, really, what is going on? So it happens. Even though my eyes were open, the smoke was experienced not by my eyes, but by my mental consciousness. At this stage, the karma for the next life hasn't ripened, but there are indications of the future life. They can manifest, and so the dying person can experience agitation and anguish, fearful visions. This can be, it's not definite, but can be an indication of an unfortunate rebirth. If the dying person experiences pleasant visions, a sense of peace, no distress, then that's an indication they're probably ripening a virtuous karma for a happy rebirth. The third stage is a weakening of the discrimination aggregate. So as the discrimination is weakened, the dying person loses their memory of the affairs of close friends and relatives. Might still be able to remember relatives, but can't remember where they fit in or give the wrong name to different people. The wisdom of individual discrimination, which for us is our knowledge of the names and the classifications and so on of different things. Our ability to distinguish between things. So the sign of this weakening is that we forget the names of our relatives. This wisdom is represented by Bodhi Amitabha, red in colour. And the perfection of this knowledge, which we all have, is the awareness of the difference between everyone and everything, every phenomenon. Be able to distinguish all things in the universe. This is this. It's hard to imagine. But the Dhammakaya is omniscient. The fire element begins to weaken. Normally the function of fire element is ripening or digestion. It is the nature of warmth. The body now starts to become very cold, digestion stops, and the coldness approaches from above and below towards the middle of the chest. The sense of smell stops, and there's short inhalation and long exhalation. The sense of smell is lost, and that inner vision, which has been like smoke, now becomes very, very dark. And it's like at night if you poke a fire out in the open and the red sparks rise up in the blackness. So there's this inner vision of red sparks in black background. This third step of death, this is when our mind ripens the karma for the next life. This is crucial. We still have a degree of capacity to discriminate, to distinguish between virtue and non-virtue. We still have, even at this point, therefore, as we have that capacity, we have the ability to consciously put our mind in virtue and abandon non-virtue. That is of vital importance, because at this time the karma for the future of life is going to ripen, and only a happy rebirth comes from the ripening of a virtuous karma, and a virtuous karmic propensity or seed can only ripen in a virtuous state of mind. And a non-virtuous karmic potency, which leads to an unhappy rebirth, animal, hungry ghost or hell being, can only ripen in a non-virtuous mind. This is of critical importance. This is where we can determine our future life, because if we can distinguish between virtue and non-virtue through having learnt about it in our life and having practiced establishing our mind in virtue and abandoning non-virtue during life, now we can consciously maintain our mind in virtue. And no matter how much negative karma we may have accumulated, that cannot ripen. And the mind is virtuous. And of course, the most important virtue is our relationship with our teacher, our guru, our Dhamma, the Buddha, who represent Shakyamuni Buddha. If we can maintain our mind in refuge in guru, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, can't be reborn in the lower realms. Cannot. Because a negative karma can't ripen. But if we lose it, and we let anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, a disturbing emotion manifest, no choice. Lower realms. So, difficult to do it when we're dying. We must train our mind in Dharma now. In a way we are dying, but it's not as bad as this point. So, here, after this, as we enter the fourth stage of death, the karma has ripened, but the mind is becoming more and more subtle. So it's more or less, we're sinking into death now. It can still be reversed, but we're approaching death. The fourth stage is a weakening of the volitions aggregate. The body can no longer move. The fourth wisdom, the wisdom of accomplishment, for us is our ability to set goals and attain goals in this life and in future lives. Is lost. The perfection of this wisdom is represented by Buddha Amoghasiddhi, green in colour. And the perfection is the awareness of how to accomplish the temporary and the ultimate aims of all sentient beings throughout the universe. Incredible. This is how Buddhas work for others. They know exactly what each sentient being in the universe is doing, what they need, and can manifest. If that sentient being is receptive, they can manifest to help them. The dying person completely forgets the purpose of external work of, you know, all the affairs of this life are just forgotten. The wind element fades. At this point, the breathing stops. But the person is not yet dead. Taste sense stops. Tongue goes blue. Sense of touch is lost. And the inner vision, instead, like prior, was many sparks in black, to now a single point of light in the total blackness. It's likened to a candle at the bottom of a deep well. So that's the fourth stage of death. Not yet dead. The fifth stage is the weakening of the consciousness aggregate, the final of the five aggregates. In particular, the conceptual mental consciousnesses. So the wisdom associated with this is called the wisdom of Dhammadhatu. And the wisdom of Dhammadhatu, it's equivalent to the mental consciousness with its potential to become the Dharmakaya. So our mental consciousness now has the potential to become the Dharmakaya. And the perfection of this wisdom is represented by Buddha Akshobhya, blue in colour. And it is the awareness of the entire sphere of reality, the two levels of truth, conventional truth and ultimate truth, of all beings and all things throughout the universe. So during this fifth stage, there are five steps, as the other had five steps. First is the cessation of the 80 primitive conceptions. So now, at this point, all the winds have contracted away from the periphery. And from the upper part of the body, they've all gathered at the top of the crown chakra, the opening, the central channel, and they start flowing down in the central channel. They're becoming more and more subtle. And as they do so, from the crown chakra, they carry down this white drop energy derived originally from the Father, and there's experience of the white vision. There are 80 primitive conceptions. The coarsest ones, 33 coarsest ones, cease at this time. The examples of these are thoughts, primitive, instinctive thoughts of repulsion, sorrow, fear, hunger, thirst, and protectiveness. These cease. And the mind, instead of having that final pinpoint of light, the vision is called the white vision, which is like the full moon tonight. It's full moon tonight, I think, but in a very clear autumn sky, where the full moon is here, but the whiteness, the radiance, is in the black. So the white vision isn't the full moon itself, but it is the radiance in the dark space behind. Next day, the winds from the lower part of the body come from the lower path, enter the central channel, and they carry up to the navel chakra, red drop energy derived from the mother, towards the heart chakra. There is the red vision. The next more subtle primitive thoughts stop, such as longing, satisfaction, the urge to suckle, to kiss, to hug, or to be unruly. These are examples. These cease. So the vision now is like the deep coppery red of a sunset. Again, not where the sun is, but where the black space is here, and there's a red sunset happening here, and it's a redness in that blackness that occurs. Then all the winds becoming more and more subtle, the minds becoming more and more subtle, enter I didn't mention this before, but what is called the indestructible drop. Tomorrow we'll go into it in more detail, but at conception, there's the sperm from the father, the egg from the mother, and the consciousness from the past life. So these three things coming together. And within the sperm and the egg, from the mother and father, there's red drop energy and white drop energy. So with the union of sperm and egg, it says that the red drop energy and the white drop energy come together forming a capsule. Like that. Hollow in the middle. And when the consciousness from the bardo enters the fertilized egg, the consciousness is at the clear light level, and that enters that capsule. So that capsule is called the indestructible drop. Remember the union of most subtle wind and most subtle mind, the clear light, is the eternal drop. Eternal because of no beginning, no end. The indestructible drop, this capsule of white and red drop energy, is called indestructible because that remains indestructible from conception up until death, the final moment of death. So, it has been there, center of our heart chakra, since we were conceived. And the most subtle wind and mind, the eternal drop, have abided inside that. So now that we're dying, all the wind energies which had arisen from that original most subtle wind energy and all the gross consciousnesses all absorb back more and more subtle. So they all go back inside the indestructible drop, and there's what's called the black vision, like total blackness. Tropics is a good example in the night. I remember when I was a young doctor, I worked in New Guinea, which, like Singapore, is on the equator. And I remember a tropical night where there's clouds and there's nothing as black and dark as a tropical night. And I remember one time being called out to the hospital, and I didn't have a torch or anything. And my car was in the yard outside, and it was just so black, I couldn't see anything. And I got into my car, you know, feeling, and it wasn't in a garage, it was in the open, but, and then I realized I was in the back seat. I wasn't drunk. Some nights I could have been. Anyway, that's my illustration of the black vision, like total blackness. At the black vision, the most subtle visions cease. And illustrations of boredom, indifference, and laziness. This is a gross laziness, it's a very subtle type of laziness. So this is all happening after we stop breathing. It can be happening like that, or it can take up to 3 days. Then there's a slight movement, slight separation, and the final vision of death, the clear light vision, occurs. So you have this indestructible drop. And that is the final bit. You're still alive, but with the slight separation, then the mind, the eternal drop, separates from the body. And it's said that the white substance goes down and exits through the sex organ, and the red substance exits through the nose, or the sign. A sign of blood or red mucus of the nose indicates that has happened. And immediately the next life begins. No, sorry, the bardo, the intermediate state begins. And so the eternal drop becomes more coarse, and due to that karma, which are ripened during the absorption of the aggregate of discrimination, the bardo being, the intermediate state body, has the aspect of the future life. If the karma to be human ripened, it'll look like a small human, size of a 6-year-old child. Animal, it'll be aspect of a horse or a fish or whatever. Okay, so that is the sequence of the 25 steps during the death process. Tomorrow we can talk about this again and learn a bit more. So that's enough for today. So there's more to come, but what we've done today, we have discussed a very important aspect of the Buddha's teachings and how to practice Dharma and how important it is to practice. So let's dedicate the positive energy of today to all sentient beings by thinking that through this positive merit that collectively we've created, may we all achieve the 5 supreme wisdoms represented by the 5 wisdom Buddhas, Buddhahood, and with that vast knowledge, may we repay the kindness of all mother sentient beings by forever being there to answer their call when they cry out, for help. I will be the one who will help them. Thank you very much. Thank you for your attention, and we'll see you tomorrow.